Today we're going to hear an interview recorded recently at the Jean Cocteau Cinema with George R.R. Martin, author of the book series A Song of Ice and Fire, and producer and writer of the television series Game of Thrones. The event was a benefit for the New Mexico Book Association.
I've been reading about your life and your work and how you got your start, and when you were a kid, you read voraciously and you sold your stories for pennies to the other kids and did dramatic readings. And
I like doing dramatic readings.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I was thinking about something that I heard one of the Beatles say when asked about his first album, they're about the Beatles' first album. And he said, look, we weren't trying to be superstars. We were trying to make a record. And I was wondering how, when you were young, you envisioned your future life as a writer.
Well, you know, I you don't really envision it. You can only hope, you know, you can only hope. You take one thing at a time. I mean, when I was young, I was just trying to write stories for the comic book fanzines. Those were my first stories. Get them published, hoping that people liked them. It was a thrill for me when someone noticed my story and there were 2-3 letters saying what a good story he wrote. Then my goal, of course, became to make a professional sale and to actually get money for my writing, which I managed to achieve in my graduate year at college, where I sold my first story to Galaxy for $94. That was a lot of money in those days. I really liked getting that $94. And then, of course, you want to sell a second story to prove it's not a fluke, and then you want to sell a third story, and then you want to sell to, okay, I've sold to Galaxy, I've sold to Amazing, I've sold to Analog, but I haven't sold to FNSF, so let me aim a story there. I haven't sold to these original anthologies. You're always broadening that. At some point, you finally decide, or at least I did, to write your first novel. It took me 6 years. I wrote short stories for 6 years before I attempted that first novel, because novels were very intimidating to me. Believe it or not, you know, I wrote short in the early days. It was very, God, this story is 10,000 words long. How, it's impossibly long. Now, of course, I turn out 300,000 words when I'm supposed to be writing 50, so things have certainly changed with the passage of years. But I don't think you ever sit down and say, well, I want to be, you know, a bestseller, or I want to be that. You just hope for the best. It was my goal when I first began selling in the 70s. My goal at that point was to make a living as a writer, to be able to give up my day jobs, which is not something I thought I could do earlier. I mean, in college and even in high school, which is really where I first decided I wanted to be a writer as opposed to an astronaut or something like that. I did research, and most writers don't actually make a living from their writing. They do it, and that was certainly true in science fiction. You looked at people like Clifford Simak, second grandmaster of SFWA, you know, brilliant writer, but he was a journalist. He spent his entire career as a journalist on small newspapers in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and just wrote nights and weekends and wrote in his spare time. He didn't go full-time till he retired. There were a few exceptions. Robert A. Heinlein was pretty much a full-time writer from the first, but they were rare. Most of the writers that I grew up reading had to have other jobs to support themselves and put their kids through college and, you know, paid a mortgage. So I sort of reconciled myself to that, too. That was one of the reasons I chose Northwestern, where I went to school, and I got a journalism degree. It was, well, what if I don't make it as a writer? What can I possibly do? Well, I am good with words, so I'll study journalism, and I'll be a reporter, and then I'll write these science fiction stories on the side.
Did your work as a journalist or your study of journalism inform the way you wrote fiction at all?
I don't know if it influenced the way I wrote fiction. It influenced my style because, you know, the journalism professors I had were very much of the old school of, you know, make it lean, make it tight. They would be horrified by what I'm writing these days. They were always, like, crossing out adjectives and all of that, and I had, going into that, the stuff I wrote in high school, the amateur stuff, some sword and sorcery and fantasy and a lot of superhero stories and prose, tended to be very purple. I always thought, you know, if one adjective was good, three would be better. journalism cured me of that, and I think produced a better style. But the really main thing that journalism did for me, journalism school anyway, was open me up to the world. You know, as a kid, I was a very, very shy kid. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was shy around other kids and all that. You know, I was a dreamy kid who read a lot and spent a lot of time in his room reading and writing, making up my own stories, playing games with myself, kind of thing. And when in the company of strangers, I would tend to be very quiet. Journalism forced me out of that because, you know, I had to get out and report on people. I would get an assignment. I had to go interview some guy I'd never met. I had to go to a demonstration. It was the 60s. There were a lot of demonstrations. There was demonstration every week. And I had to interview the cops and the demonstrators and, you know, everybody and get right in the middle of things. And it threw me into all these situations and really broke down that kind of shyness and reticence that I had. So I became able to talk to people and more than that, to listen to people, to hear their stories and to hear everybody's different viewpoint and the different voices that people had. And I think all of that enriched my writing immeasurably.
Talk about the science fiction and fantasy market and its fan base. How does that compare to other forms of fiction?
It's been different. It's been different for a long time. You know, science fiction was a pulp genre. I mean, if you study the whole history of science fiction, it began with Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, you know, for practical purposes, but it wasn't a genre yet. It became a genre in 1926 when a guy named Hugo Gernsback launched the first science fiction magazine, Amazing Stories. And it was a pulp magazine in an era when there were hundreds of pulp magazines, the mystery pulps. There were adventure pulps like The Shadow. There were, you know, men's adventure pulps fighting Nazis and on tropical islands. There were Western pulps. There were romance pulps. There were hundreds of these magazines, and they people made a living writing for them. A pulp writer only got a penny a word, and sometimes for the lesser pulps, half a cent a word, a quarter cent a word. So you had to write very fast and down and dirty and all that. And science fiction was never the most successful of the pulps. It was there. There were like a half dozen science fiction magazines. Sometimes it got bigger, where there would be a little boom, and there would be like 20 of them, but then most of them would fail, and it would go back down again. So they were a pulp genre. But then something very curious happened in the early 50s, where television came in, and the pulps died. One by one, all the pulps died. I mean, they'd been there between the wars and through World War II and in the aftermath of World War II, but they couldn't survive the competition of television. And one by one, they all died except for science fiction. The science fiction pulps were the only ones that really survived. A couple mystery pulps, and we still see them today in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. But the other survivors were all the science fiction magazine. The other thing that happened was in the 30s, people wrote letters to the pulps about what stories they liked, what stories they did not like. And in those days, they printed your full address when they printed your letter, something they don't do these days. So the fans of science fiction began to write to each other and said, oh, you like Doc Smith too? I like Doc Smith. And then in the late 30s, they started meeting together for the first science fiction conventions. The first one was held in Philadelphia, I think, in like 1938 or so. They call it a convention. It was like, you know, six guys from Philadelphia were visited six guys from New York. And then they wrote in their amateur fanzines, big convention held. People come from all over the East Coast. And then the next year, 1939, they had the WorldCon, the grand, you know, because they were having the World's Fair in New York City. So they, the World Convention instead, and people came to that. And so this whole subculture of science fiction fandom grew up. And it sustained the pulps, I think, the science fiction pulps, when the rest of them went. And these fans were very intent and very expert. They were expert readers. They read a lot. And it wasn't just a casual reading thing. They knew the authors. They knew their stories. They knew, well, this story was all right, but it's really derivative of this one that Stanley Weinbaum did 10 years ago, you know? And they would meet at these conventions and heatedly argue the points, and the writers started going to these conventions. So by the time I came along in the 60s and 70s, there was already this thriving subculture that went back 20 years. And it's a subculture that persists to this day, although there have been many changes over the years. One of the things that the survival of the Pulps meant, though, was that in the early 70s when I broke in, and indeed to a certain extent today, although not as much, science fiction still had magazines publishing original short fiction. And I've always said my advice to young writers is start with short stories. I get letters all the time from fans of my work who are aspiring writers. Hi, I'm a 16-year-old kid, and I'm writing this 9-book fantasy epic series, and I want your advice. And my advice is, you don't write a 9-book fantasy epic series. It's going to take you 20 years, and it'll be garbage at the end here. Learn your craft first by writing some short stories. See if you can get some short stories published. Experiment with different voices and different writing techniques and, you know, different ways of building character and see what works, see what doesn't work, find your own voice, but do it in short stories. And you can do that in science fiction. You can do that to this day. The magazines, since there's not much money in short stories, the science fiction and fantasy magazines are always looking for new writers. Because the writers like me, we go on because $94 isn't enough anymore. So I want more than that, so I don't really write short stories very often except for these anthologies like Warriors. So they have to keep finding new writers, and the publishing pattern is people break in with short stories, they publish short stories for a few years, maybe they win some awards, and then they finally publish their first novel, and then they make the transition to writing novels, which of course is where the money is, to the extent that there is any money.
Now you, I think, have been a very active part of that subculture that you're describing. What has it done for you? I mean, I imagine that part of it is promotion, but it probably goes beyond that as well.
Yes, it's you know, I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, so it was a different time. People who wrote liked comic books and who liked science fiction were not the most popular kids in school. We were the geeks, the nerds, and you know, geek has become like a word of pride now, and even nerd, you know, they have TV shows, Biggest Nerd or something like that. It was not a good thing to be a geek or a nerd back in 1959. It was something you were being picked on. And so finding the like-minded company of other people who also like comic books, who also read the same writers you do, who could discuss whether Heinlein was better than Asimov and you know, what the hell A. E. Van Vogt was talking about, and you know, some of the other things we argued about was great. And like many other people, when I went to those first conventions, I had a feeling I've found my people here. I've found the people who speak the same language I do and who love the same things I do. And I've been going to conventions ever since. I went to my first science fiction convention in 1971. I already sold 2 stories at the time, so I was a pro, or a filthy pro, as they call it. But once I sampled it, I kept going back for it. You learned a lot at those conventions, too, because there were panel discussions, and you could attend them, editors talking about what they wanted for their magazines, and writers talking about how to handle, you know, different literary techniques. There were some heated literary arguments. I mean, the 60s were the time of the new wave in science fiction, and at the conventions, you could see the new wave writers and the old wave writers battering at each other and calling each other names. That was very entertaining. And eventually, of course, you made friends there. And so that's one of the reasons I still go back now, is to see my friends from all over the world.
You sold your first story, as you said, in 1970 at the age of 21. And I was wondering if you could tell, I mean, we're here with the New Mexico Book Association, and they want very much to hear about to hear information that would be interesting for aspiring writers. How has the market for fiction in general changed and not changed, and science fiction in particular, since you published your first story?
Well, it's changing. I mean, there have been some changes from 1971 into the, when I broke in into the 80s and the 90s. But it's really with the turn of the millennium and the growth of the internet that the change has accelerated. And we're now in a period, you know, like the ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. These are real interesting times for publishing, and I don't know where it's going. Many people have different theories about it. Certainly, we're seeing the rise of ebooks. You know, I've seen that dramatically myself. 6 years ago, ebooks were infinitesimal in my royalty statements. You know, there was a huge chunk there for print books, and then second place was audiobooks, which was way, way smaller than print books, maybe, you know, a 20th. And then time the bottom, it was this ebook thing that, oh, I earned $9 this year from ebooks. Ebooks about 3 years ago passed audiobooks at the second place, and now they're, on my royalty statements, they're bumping right up against print books and threatening to edge past them. So we're seeing the explosive growth of ebooks, and there's huge controversies and problems associated with that. I mean, those of you who follow publishing know about the current war going on between Amazon and Hachette, you know, one of the six great publishers, the Big Six, as they're called in New York, and Amazon, the mega bookseller of the country and the world. And I don't know who's going to win that, but it's a crucial decision here about how ebooks will be priced, how ebooks will be controlled, who will have the final authority over how ebooks are priced and sold. That's an important struggle that's going on. We've also seen the rise of self-publishing, people putting their stories out on the internet or doing print-on-demand books. You know, there's always been self-publishing. Back in the 50s, 60s, we called it vanity publishing. And it was basically someone who was a fool would do it. They wanted to have their book out. They couldn't get a publisher to take it on. They would go to one of these vanity publishers who would charge them to print their book, and then they would wind up with a garage full of 1,000 copies or 2,000 copies of their book that they would pathetically take by the bookstores who wouldn't want it. That old vanity press scenario has changed now because there have been some huge success stories with self-publishing. People who have put their things on the internet and they found an audience. Some of them have attracted editors from professional houses who have then engaged them to write for the, you know, for a professional house, given them a contract. John Scalzi started that way. Old Man's War was his first novel. He was putting that on the internet, and editors saw it, and the fans saw it, of course. Of course, for every one of those, there are lots of writers who don't find an audience. I mean, there's probably 100 or 1,000 writers who are self-publishing, and six people are reading their stuff. And more are having their books printed. I mean, I still go to conventions. You know, you go to Bubonicon, even the little local science fiction convention that's held in Albuquerque every year, and you'll find booksellers there with tables selling the latest books. You'll find used booksellers selling old books. And you'll always find, and more with every year, the self-published authors who have bought a table and they're sitting behind it with hundreds of copies of their book and hoping to sell three or something like that. And people are like rushing past them and not meeting their eyes because you don't want to make eye contact because then they might try to talk with you and bring them over to, and then you feel kind of obligated because the poor guy is sitting there and you feel that you got to buy his book. But I don't want to, I mean, many of these self-published books are awful. They're self-published because they can't find a real publisher. But not all of them. Some of them are damn good. People, you know, a guy at a Phoenix convention a couple years ago gave me this first chapter of his self-published fantasy book. And I took it home with me. All right, he seems like a nice guy. And book was nicely produced, but God, another self-published book. And I got home and this is a terrific book. This is great. This is going to be a very entertaining. I want to read the rest of it. And I hope he writes it and comes out with it. But I wish he'd contact a real publisher about it. So right now, I think real publishing is still the way to go, the New York publishing. But there's no doubt that self-publishing is getting bigger and bigger, and the self-publishing, e-publishing, all of this stuff is changing the field beyond recognition.
If you have a self-published book and it's an e-book, then you don't have to take the risk of publishing all these things that are going to stack up in your garage.
That is true. That is true. But how do you get people to read it? I mean, that's part of it. I mean, right. For me, I'm a writer. I like being published by a publisher because I'm not an editor. I like having an editor. I like having a copy editor. I like having a publicist. I like someone to handle the distribution of my books and put them in big trucks and drive them all over the country. I don't want to take on all these tasks myself. I think new systems may eventually evolve for self-publishing, but right now there's no gatekeepers. Anyone can self-publish. You know, you can be a terrific writer and self-publish, or you can be absolutely dreadful and self-publish anyway, and you don't realize you're dreadful. Actually, I think self-publishing is working, and it is working primarily for writers who are already established. Like my friend Walter John Williams in Albuquerque, a very talented science fiction writer. Walter has a long body of older books that have been out of print. He's self-published all of those as e-books, and he's getting a good income from that. But he's Walter John Williams. He's won a Nebula Award. He's been nominated for numerous Nebulas and Hugos. Science fiction fans know who he is. So an established writer, instead of getting a 10% royalty from a publisher, can self-publish his books and get a 90% royalty, which is certainly better. I mean, if you're getting 90% and 10, then you can make money on a lot fewer book sales. But it doesn't work if nobody knows who the hell you are. I mean, you're Joe Blow writing your first book. You put it out on the internet, or who's going to buy it? Who's going to see it? Where are the gatekeepers? You know, we need reviewers. We need, you know, they. Traditional publishers acted as gatekeepers. They had the slush pile under the transom. I've seen them. The magazines had thousands of stories packed up. Okay, I got to wade through these thousands of stories. Most of it was garbage, and I find the five or six that are good enough to make the magazine. So when you buy a copy of Analog or the magazine of science fiction and fantasy, or the New Yorker, I mean, it works the same way in other fields. The editor has vouched for the contents. The editor has been served as a gatekeeper and said, yeah, this is good stuff here. There's no gatekeepers with the internet and the self-publishing. So it's really rolling the dice. And the internet is a wild and woolly world out there. So you never know what you're going to encounter.
There are some writers who have been working for years. They write a novel and another novel and another novel, don't sell anything. And finally, they get a novel, get interest in it. Where can they then go to get information about the business of writing, which they may not really know because they've been spending all their time in front of their computer and maybe teaching writing, but they really don't know the business?
Well, if they're a science fiction and fantasy writer, they should go to the conventions. That's where I learned a lot about it. I mean, there are panel discussions about the business of writing. But you can listen to those. There are lectures, there are interviews like we're doing here, where people will talk about the business of writing and you can learn things. But even more valuable than that, there's the bar. And you go to a bar and you sit around with other writers and that you learn, you know, through the process. I mean, science fiction has always had this kind of, I don't want to call it mentoring, that makes it sound too much, but people being willing to help the younger writers coming up and giving them advice and all of that. Robert A. Heinlein, first science fiction writer I ever read, and certainly one of the huge towering names in the field, was the one who said it many decades ago. He said, I can never pay back the people who helped me on the way up, so I feel a compulsion to pay forward and to help the people come after me. And that paying forward has always been a big part of science fiction fantasy. It's not a formal, I'm going to mentor you and take you as my protege. I get letters occasionally from people saying, would you take me as your protege? And my answer is no. Go away. Sitting at the bar, having a beer at a convention, I'm certainly willing to to hold forth on my experiences and the do's and don'ts and mistakes you could make and all of that. And there's a lot of knowledge that has passed along that way. But mind you, this takes place in the subculture of science fiction fantasy. For people who are writing historical fiction or mysteries or literary fiction, I don't know where they get it, because they don't have that convention subculture. Well, literary fiction has a little of it. It's academic based. I've been to a few literary conventions and conferences and so forth. But science fiction has always been a world apart in that way.
You, at a certain point, started writing for television. How did you learn the craft of TV writing?
Well, I kind of was thrown into the deep end of the pool, and I had to swim or sink. One of the things about a career as a writer, if any of you are contemplating it, is there's no security. If you're a guy who needs security, pick some other field, because you're not going to find it here. This writing fiction, especially, is for someone who can deal with wild swings in your fortune and careers that flourish and then collapse and so forth. And I've certainly been through that. My career was golden for maybe the first 10 years of my career. I was going from one success after another. And my biggest success was my fourth novel, The Armageddon Rag, the first time I got paid a six-figure advance, the book that was going to be my breakout book and make me a bestseller. My publishers were over-enthused about it, got some great reviews, got nominated for some awards, and no one bought it. And I discovered, after no one bought it, that my career was essentially over. It's like you're only as hot as your latest book. After my fourth novel tanked, I couldn't sell my fifth novel. Publishers were passing on it, and I was, I'd made several rookie mistakes. You talk about advice here. One of them was I'd sold that book for a six-figure advance, I went out and bought a new car and a much bigger house. Don't go out and buy a new car and a much bigger house. don't do that, because then you have a much bigger mortgage, and when your book tanks, then how do you pay your mortgage? So. Fortunately, Hollywood came along at just that time. Oddly enough, also through the Armageddon Rag, although not many people bought it, one of the ones who did was a television writer and producer named Phil Duguerre. And Phil wanted to make a movie out of the Armageddon Rag. So he optioned it, and he flew me out, and we met. And he never got the movie off the ground, but a couple years later, he got the assignment to revive The Twilight Zone. And Phil did something very unusual. He reached out to prose writers, people who had no experience in television or film. So he called me up and said, do you want to write a script for The Twilight Zone? Of course, I'd grown up with The Twilight Zone with Rod Serling. I mean, that was my favorite story as a kid, and now it was coming back. I said, yeah, okay, I'd like to do that, but, I've never written a script. I don't know how to write a script. He said, it's easy. I'll send you a bunch of scripts. So he sent me a bunch of scripts, and I read them. And then what I did is I went through my copious collection of old magazines, and I found short stories that I thought would make good Twilight Zone episodes. And I sent Phil about 30 of them, because I figured, okay, I need to master this form. I don't need to be trying to think up a good story, too. So I'll take some stuff that I already know are good stories, and then all I have to do is learn the process of adaptation and learn the screenplay thing. So the first Twilight Zone of mine produced was by Santa Fe's own Roger Zelazny, The Last Defender of Camelot. We bought that story from Roger, and I adapted it. It was the first script of mine filmed. And it was an education, the adaptation process, and then watching it be filmed was one of the great memories of my life. When first time you see something that's only been words on a paper, visions in your head, assuming tangible reality as actors are saying your words and set designers are building a set and costumers are making the costumes that you described. It's almost magical. And next thing I knew, I was on staff on Twilight Zone, and I was doing it all the time. And we had a great writing staff on that show, not only Phil himself, but Rockne O'Bannon, Alan Brennert, a guy named Harlan Ellison, Michael Cassatt, all of them people with prose credentials who have gone on to do great things, and indeed many of them had done great things by that point. So, you know, every time I finish a draft, they would rip it apart and tell me how I went wrong, and I got a pretty good education on the job there from them.
You chose the medium of television for Game of Thrones when you could have gone the direction of film, and I mean, there's amazing things happening in television now. It's a very interesting moment in television, and it makes sense, of course, when you have an epic to be able to tell it over multiple seasons rather than a movie or a couple of movies. But one of the things that I wondered about was when you make a film for television, turn your books into television, you kind of miss the big giant screen. And for an epic of the type that of work that you're writing, I wondered if you thought about that.
Well, no, not really. I got offers to sell the rights as a feature. And while the big giant screen is certainly cool and attractive, I knew they couldn't possibly do my story. They would have had to rip it apart. The story was too big, too complex, too many characters. I didn't think it could be filmed at all, frankly, without removing, you know, 90% of the characters. And indeed, that's what some of the early guys who wanted to do as features were pitching and saying, well, it's, you know, it's really about Daenerys. We'll concentrate on her. We'll get rid of all these other characters. It's really about Jon Snow, whatever. And I know it's about all of them, and we got to have all the scripts and all the stories in intertwining together. And the only way to do that is television. And HBO had already been doing so amazing stuff with television, with shows like The Sopranos and Deadwood. And I said, yeah, not only can we only do it with television, but we can only do it with a premium cable thing, HBO being the first choice. There are a few others, Showtime Stars, who do similarly good work. HBO is the best, I think. But I'd worked, in the 10 years that I was out there working in television film, I'd worked primarily for the broadcast networks. And I was just so frustrated with the limits they put on you with the censorship and the standards and practices. And no, you can't have, you can only say the F word 3 times in an hour. You can't say it 4 times. You know, they have all these crazy rules here. And no sex and no violence. It's loosened up some, but compared to the 80s when I was doing it. But it's still pretty tightly controlled. And Game of Thrones and its sequels were clearly adult fare. There was a lot of sex and violence, and I didn't see the sense in ripping all of that out in order to make it tame and safe for a CBS or an NBC audience. So it had to be HBO. Fortunately, David Benioff and Dan Weiss felt the same way, and fortunately, they convinced HBO. So here we are today.
To what extent can you now maintain control over your work and your vision? To what extent do you have to let go of control of this work?
Well, I maintain complete control over the books. The TV show I maintain no control over. I have a voice. I write a script a year usually. I am a co-executive producer on it, but I'm not in Belfast. I'm not meeting with the writers every day. I'm devoting myself to writing the next 2 books, so I can't control it. And you can't get that kind of control for the most part, even with the level of success that I had, which was pretty good by the time they bought the books. The series was doing really, really well, was very popular, but it was not enough to wrest control away from Hollywood. The studios don't like to give up control. Occasionally someone can get it. If you're J.K. Rowling, you have Harry Potter, it's the best-selling thing in the world, every studio in Hollywood wants it, you can get control. Almost no one else gets control. What you do get is money, you know. It's like Hollywood said, well, we'll give you, you know, we'll give you $1 million. And you say, okay, that's good. $1 million. I like $1 million, and I would like control. And then they, oh, no control. We'll give you $2 million. No, I do $2 million. I'll take that. But I want the control. I want the approval, script approval. $3 million. $3 million. So eventually the number gets so high, fuck control. You know, I mentioned Roger Zelazny earlier. Roger, of course, lives here in Santa Fe and was one of my closest friends and one of the greatest writers of science fiction and fantasy ever produced. He didn't have many of his works adapted for the film, for the screen. The one that was adapted was his novel, Damnation Alley. And boy, did they mess that up. They just made a total hash of it, and they made a stinker of a movie. Just a stinker. Do any of you know Damnation Alley? It's as a novel, it's a riveting. It's not Roger's best novel by any means, but it's very exciting. It's kind of Road Warrior. It's a Hell's Angel named Hell Tanner has to take a serum in a post-apocalyptic world across country from Los Angeles to Boston, where the whole city is going to die. And he's beset by banker gangs and mutants and various other horrible things along the way. It's a very exciting kind of book. And Hollywood took it and messed it up totally. They cast Jan Michael Vincent in the role, and they made him an army guy instead of a Hell's Angel. And, you know, we call him Heck Tanner instead of Hell Tanner. But Roger got the money from that, and he built a beautiful new wing on his house and, like, the nicest office I'd ever seen. And I asked him once, well, don't you hate what Hollywood did with Damnation Alley? And he said, he quoted to me James M. Cain, the great, you know, noir novelist of the 30s, who'd been asked the same question. And they said to him, well, what do you think about what Hollywood has done to your books? And Cain answered, Hollywood hasn't done anything to my books. See, they're right over there on the shelf. It's exactly the same words as when I wrote them. That story, by the way, it was Cain. So if anyone ever tells you it was Raymond Chandler or someone else, or don't believe them, it was Cain. I've looked that up. That quote gets attributed to a lot of people. But for me, it was Roger who said it, quoting Cain. And he's right, and that's what I look at with Ice and Fire. You know, the series has been great. I hope it will continue to be great, but it's not the books. It's different from the books. They have to make changes in the process of adaptation. But the books are the same. The books are there on the shelf, and I have complete control over them. And whether they're good or bad, that's up to me. That's in my authority.
Do you take breaks from A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones to do other creative work?
Well, I do other creative work, like Rogues. I edit anthologies. I edit my Wild Card series, which has been going since 1987. I do occasional scripts or consult on a game or something like that. One of the interesting things that is that with the level of success that we've been having, I'm getting all sorts of offers come my way. And probably about 5-6 years ago, when it first really started happening, I made a mistake and I said yes too often, because some of them were cool offers and they sounded like be a lot of fun and there was a lot of money attached, and I said yes, and I probably said yes too much. These days I'm trying to practice to say no, 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 no. I'm still not very good of it. I mean, look at me, here I am, because Jim asked me and I said yes. I probably should have said no, but I still say yes. But I never stop writing on the books. It's like I'm doing other things, whether it's speaking or attending a convention or editing a book or writing a short story or writing an introduction. I do all these things, but I'm still working on the main thing, which is the books.
I put this event on Facebook earlier today, and one listener to the radio show wrote back and said, you shouldn't be doing this. You should be giving him time to write. And another person wrote and said, please, please ask him if there will ever be a movie or series based on Fever Dream.
Fever Dream, my third novel, a historical horror novel about vampires on the Mississippi. Yes, I hoped it would be. At one point during my first Hollywood career, back in the early 90s, Touchstone Pictures had me option that book and had me write a screenplay on it myself. And then they never made it, so it went into turnaround, so I got the rights to that back. So I now have the screenplay. And I've had discussions with various people about adapting it. I like my screenplay, and I want my own screenplay to be used, so it's gotten a little more complicated on two levels. First of all, of course, Touchstone paid for that. I have to reimburse Touchstone, so anyone who's going to buy that has to pay me enough money so I don't have a loss on it, and I reimburse Touchstone, and then the rights to it will be clear. But there, you meet people out there who want to do their own version. They like the book, but they don't like your screenplay, so they I'll just buy the underlying material, have a new screenplay. And to that, I say, no. No, I want my screenplay used. So we've had a couple interested directors, pretty big-name directors, who have been interested in recent years, but, you know, Hollywood is endless talks and very few deals ever close. You know, it's you dance around it. Probably one of the reasons I went back to books is I just got so tired of the endless courtship rituals out there. With whether a deal was going to make or not. I'm more interested in telling stories and making movies, making television, not in making deals. But so I'd love it, but I don't know if it'll ever happen. We'll see.
You have realized the dream that most writers hope for, which is success and that your work is read and seen by millions of people. Are there any parts of that success that are troublesome or that you don't like?
Yes. Success is good. It certainly beats failure. And I've been successful for most of my career. I've had bumps, like the Armageddon rag years. I've had bumps out in Hollywood where I was very hot for a while and then a couple projects died and suddenly I wasn't hot anymore. And that's what I talked about, not being a profession for people who like security. You got to be kind of a gambler to be in this field. What you should do is marry a spouse who has a nice steady job and income that you can rely upon. That would be good. And then they can provide the regular thing and you provide the largesse when you hit the, it's like winning a lottery occasionally. And the level of success got bigger and bigger for me. I was hitting the bestseller lists with the second of the Ice and Fire books, The Clash of Kings. And by the fourth book, I was number one on the bestseller list. And that was great. But the show took me into a whole new stratosphere. And part of that was good. If you have a movie come out, if you write a book and they make it into a movie, it's great for your book, especially if it's a good movie. If it's a bad movie, forget it. It doesn't do much. But if it's a good movie, you'll get a spike in your sales when the movie comes out. People buy your book. A lot of people will buy your book. Television show, 10 times better. Because there's not a spike. It just goes up and stays up. And as long as the television show is on, you kind of live there. So that part of it is great. I like that. I like the giant dump trucks full of money. It makes me do silly things with it, like buy a movie theater. I mean, even at the height of my pre-show success, I never could have bought a movie theater. Something that I didn't really realize. I mean, I drove past the Jean Cocteau for years thinking somebody should reopen that place. And then finally one day I said, wait a minute, I have dump trucks for the money. I can reopen that place. What I don't like is being a celebrity. And I didn't realize until I wouldn't like it until it happened to me. And when it first starts to happen, it's really good. You know, it's you're excited. Writers, writers don't expect to be recognized. We're names. You know, some people know our names, but they don't necessarily know what we look like. They have a word in the science fiction fandom called ego boo, ego boosting, you know, and everybody needs a little ego boo. They need people fussing over them and all that. But I could control, for decades, I could control my ego boo. I could go to a convention and put on name tags at George R. R. Martin, and people would ask for my autograph, and I would be on panels, and people would interview me and all that. And then I could leave the convention, take off that name tag, and I'd be just another guy. With the celebrity that's come with Game of Thrones, I've lost that. Now, people on Saturday Night Live are imitating not my characters, but me. Last Halloween, there was a costume company that was doing, Game of Thrones costumes. They did Daenerys Targaryen. They did Jon Snow. You could go as any of those for Halloween, or you could go as me. You could buy suspenders and a hat and all that. I can't go to the airport or a restaurant. You know, I'm eating. Santa Fe is not so bad, but even here, it's getting there. You know, I go to a restaurant and I'm eating my meal, and someone will come up and they'll say, "I don't mean to intrude, but," which always means, "I don't mean to intrude, but I'm going to. And could you please take a picture or sign an autograph or shake my hand?" And they're all very sweet people, and they mean it. But they don't realize that they're not the first person. They may be the first person they've seen come up to me, but it's like every meal that I eat now, and I can't go through an airport without shaking 17 hands and posing for pictures. And I see some of you are probably lurking here with cell phones in your pockets. I have come to hate cell phones. I never liked those things much anyway, but it used to be that you'd only have to worry about an occasional guy who had a camera. Now everybody has a camera all the time. And they all want a selfie. And, it just gets, I don't know why anyone would want a selfie anyway, but they do, and I comply, and you have to be nice about it, because you're in some ways you're in the public spotlight. The first time I tell someone who comes up and wants a selfie to bugger off, he's going to write about it on Twitter, and people say, "Oh, what a jerk he is." Especially if he's taping me while he's doing it. But so I don't know what my advice for any writer who's experienced this success. The dump trucks full of money are great, but the fame, I would give the fame back gladly and become an anonymous guy again. And there are people who are smarter than me about that. I know, like, Cormac McCarthy lives here in Santa Fe. I know he's in this audience. I don't know what he looks like. I could be standing behind him at Albertsons, and I wouldn't know what he looks like. I know his work. I know his name, and he's very successful and probably has his own dump trucks full of money. But no one wants a selfie with him because they don't know who the hell he is. And that's probably the smarter way to do it.
And that was George R. R. Martin, author of the book series A Song of Ice and Fire, and writer and producer of the television series Game of Thrones.